Welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a place that brings together people passionate about positive impact.
The challenge is to keep thinking that it's possible to change things. And I will not tolerate people saying, oh, we can't change anything, or everything's horrible and everybody's miserable and we're all depressed and we're all divided. And, you know, I see it as we can't fall into that trap, because once that's a downward spiral. So there is always something that's possible.
My guest today is independent crossbench peer Baroness Lola Young. A Londoner born and bred, Baroness Young started her career as an actress, studying at the New College of Speech and Drama before working successfully in theatre and television. Baroness Young has held a host of significant roles in the arts and culture sector, including Professor of Cultural Studies at Middlesex University and Head of Culture at the Greater London Authority. She has served on the board of the National Theatre and the South Bank Centre, and is a regular on judging panels, chairing the Man Booker Prize in 2017. She was appointed a member of the House of Lords in 2004 and uses her political position to campaign against modern slavery and to promote ethical and sustainable fashion. Lola Young, thank you so much for joining us on the inaugural podcast here at The Conduit.
My pleasure.
So you have led an extraordinary life where you have spent an immense amount of time thinking about, caring for, and campaigning on behalf of the most vulnerable. Victims of sexual violence, people who've been subjected to modern forms of slavery, unfairness in the criminal justice system. And so I'd like to start by asking where that comes from.
It's a good question, but it might sound a little bit precocious, but actually when I was quite small, growing up in London as a little black girl in a foster home, looking at television, which was, you know, grainy black and white, big thing in the corner, and seeing people being beaten up. And those people being beaten up were black people. They were black people in the southern states of the USA, and they were black people in South Africa. And I knew that was wrong, and I very clearly identified with them in the sense that I could see that it was because they were black and not because they'd done something wrong.
And it seems to me that people subjected to those kinds of experiences can go a range of different directions. You can become angry or marginalized or depressed or rebellious or any combinations of those.
And you, all of those, done all of those.
But you clearly also developed a taste for engagement and for activism and for trying to improve things, not just criticize things. So what put you on that path?
It's really hard to pin that down, actually, Paul. And I think, again, it's partly to do with the background, partly to do with maybe the backdrop of the euphoria, supposedly, over the 1960s and how great and fab it all was. Well, it wasn't for everybody, as many people can testify. So, and I think the other thing is that one of the benefits, if I can put it like that, of not having parents and other people to tell you what to do, was that I could sort of mark my own path. So if I decided I wanted to do something, like the decision, for example, that I made to drop conventional forms of work and go into theatre was completely random and out of the blue as far as all of my friends were concerned. But I knew I could do that because that's what I wanted to do. And in fact, it was through theatre, through being involved in Equity, the Actors' Union, that really taught me how to engage with things like committees and governance structures and campaigns and strategic activities and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's a combination of factors, really.
So theatre is an unusual training ground for somebody who is going to be an activist for social change, but it seems as though it did, in fact, equip you to kind of understand how you bring about change.
Yes, well, I think it was partly because I was very fortunate to, in at least one or two of the theatres that I was working at, there was a group of very politically active people, actors mainly, and they would chew things over and discuss and analyze, and I would be listening. I also worked for playwrights that were very political in terms of the work that they were producing, people like Trevor Griffiths and Howard Brenton and David Hare, who always had something to say in their material. So it's being exposed to those kinds of debates and discussions, and at the same time knowing that, wait a minute, why was I called a witch when I was at school? Is this something to do with the history of relationships between black and white and colonialism? I wasn't quite sure where all of that came from, but I knew that that played out also in the kinds of roles I was offered, particularly in television.
Often people say that culture is the water that we swim in, and it's what conditions us and what frames our life, and it's also contested. You can shape culture, you can make culture orient people towards justice or orient people towards sexism and misogyny and racism and homophobia. So do you think culture is something that can be changed to be more progressive or more good, or and how would you go about doing it if you think it can be?
It's interesting because this word culture is very difficult, and I'm always reminded of Raymond Williams in Keywords saying that culture was one of the two or three most difficult words in the English language because it has so many complex and intertwined meanings. So there's culture in an anthropological sense, of course. There's a culture in the sense in which we tend to use it today to mean arts and creativity. But there's also that sort of slightly in-between sense of society / culture, and it's quite difficult to place what we mean by culture. So thinking about how each of those is interconnected, I think, is a very interesting occupation, something that drew me to cultural studies, which is, after all, what it does. So there is I kind of think there's different ways of thinking about the influence and the ways in which culture, in terms of culture and creativity, works. And again, I remember Stuart Hall always saying, you know, people aren't cultural dupes, although actually I think I might contest that sometimes today. But there is this sense that people actually are quite savvy sometimes about the kinds of messages and subtextual things that are coming through from culture. So they will identify that a particular play is trying to deal with class and race, or a particular film is being disrespectful and offensive about disability. So people recognise that in general terms. But what I think we're seeing today, particularly, although arguably it's always been the case, is that people actually are quite embedded in the way in which they think. And a lot of people do find it difficult to change their point of view as a result of reading, seeing and so on. So I think there's still an awful lot of work that we need to do through the cultural and creative sector, which is not actually to tell people what to think or how to be, in my view, but to say, look at this, read this newspaper, read this book. What is it trying to say to us? How does it say it to us? And how is it trying to position us in relation to the substance of what it's saying? So if it's trying to make us feel empathetic with an anti-hero, why? What is Patricia Highsmith trying to do when she kind of seduces us into seeing everything from Tom's point of view, who is a moral sociopath, basically? You know, why is it that she's trying to do, and what is it she's asking of us, and what should we be asking of ourselves in terms of the way we think about morality, criminal activity, the justice system, and so on and so forth? So to me, culture and creativity is all about asking questions, being much more analytical. Of course, I hope that people will come to similar conclusions to me, that there's a lot that needs to be changed. But I think it's quite difficult to set out to tell people what they should be thinking.
Do you have an example of something that you supported or encouraged during your time in, you know, being the kind of the head of culture in London that you think moved the dial a little bit?
Well, I think it's always hard to pinpoint the impact of a particular activity. But I do think that when I worked with colleagues on thinking about what history and heritage mean for people of African and South Asian and East Asian descent in our country in the early part of the 21st century, which is when we were looking at this in 2002-2003. So what we wanted to say was that museums and archives and other sort of keepers of the national story and the national history weren't really doing the job that they should have been doing, because they weren't looking at how those different communities, as it were, slotted in or were part of that history of Britain. It wasn't really being manifested sufficiently. It wasn't being demonstrated, for example, the long history of the presence of people of African descent in this country since before Roman times. Not many people knew that then. Still, a lot of people don't even recognise that now. But at the time, we were also having to tell people, yes, people of African, Caribbean and Asian descent fought in the Second World War. Actually, they fought in the First World War as well, and helped the war effort in many, many different ways. So we initiated a kind of inquiry into what was the state of affairs in terms of telling these histories, in terms of inserting these stories into the mainstream of British political and historical culture via museums and archives. So there was an inquiry set up. It was chaired by Dame Jocelyn Barrow. It went on for a little while and came to certain conclusions around employment, representation, and so on and so forth. So I think, you know, again, the ripples from that may not have been huge, particularly at the beginning, but people still refer back to some of the conclusions that were drawn then and will say either, yeah, we've not made hardly any progress since then, or yes, we've still got a lot of work to do, or actually we managed to break that particular barrier.
So we like to think of this podcast as a cookbook for people who are interested in positive social change. And one of the kind of recipes that you've worked on recently is around modern slavery.
Mm.
And so let's just start with telling our listeners a little bit about what the problem is, because then we're going to get you to describe your efforts and hopefully help illustrate how people might contribute to systemic social change. So why is this an issue? Why are we talking about slavery in 2019?
Yes, that's a hard question, and one to which there's no easy or simple answer, predictably. But one thing I would say is important to recognise the history of enslavement predating the transatlantic slave trade. But obviously that is particularly a huge moment in the history of many of our peoples who now populate this country, and of course white British people too. So that moment of the transatlantic slave trade and the so-called ending of it in 1807 by William Wilberforce and all the other campaigners who fought for the abolition, that wasn't the end of it. So it's carried. What's happened, in my view, is that it's just mutated over the years. It's changed. It's had different formats and different ways of sort of growing and becoming this now huge, partly or mainly criminal enterprise around the world, which we think is affecting some 40-45 million people, which is more than at the peak of the transatlantic slave trade. Now, the term is a difficult term because people immediately think slavery, people in chains and so on and so forth. And at the most extreme examples you can see, unfortunately, examples of the most extreme abuse of people in so-called employment or in labour situations. But we also include in that kind of exploitative labour and abusive labour that goes on in, for example, some garment factories where staff will be, you know, allowed to go to the toilet once a day, will be sitting at the sewing machines for 14, 15, 16 hours, will be locked into the rooms because their managers don't want them to leave in any unauthorised way. They'll be have their papers taken away if they're migrant workers. They'll have their passports taken, their identity papers. So that means effectively they're chained metaphorically to these roles. So that's the kind of state of play. And you can include in that, as I say, a wide range of abusive labour practices. So the problem that we're posed with is how do we eliminate this, and what bit of it do I think I can make a contribution to? Well, I would have to say inevitably that I wouldn't be able to even speak about this without the help and support and teaching, if you like, of many, many colleagues from a range of NGOs, individuals, politicians, et cetera, academics, of course, very important in that. So I see myself as part of an alliance which is working to reduce in the first instance and hopefully eventually eliminate the kinds of practices in labour situations that are tolerated and sometimes encouraged by our businesses. So what I'm looking at is supply chains and transparency in supply chains. And the whole idea of that particular phrase is to say to a business, what is it that you're doing? What's happening in that factory that you own in Vietnam that is producing stone for your construction industry? Do you know what's happening there? Because we can tell you from reports we've had from workers and NGOs and trade unions and other people on the ground that people are being abused in that work. Children are being used to dig out huge lumps of stone and carrying down mountain size. Are you aware of that, what's going on? And if you're not, you should be, because it's your business and you've got to take responsibility for that. So that's the kind of area that I'm working on. And in fact, what I would say, I've used stone and quarries because it's not often the most obvious thing that people think of. I think a lot of people now are more familiar with the idea that clothes may have been made under really bad working conditions and food a little bit, but actually it's everything you consume will have a risk at some point or another of having been produced by people who are being exploited in unacceptable terms.
So all of this seems so manifestly unreasonable and unlawful and unethical. So what's the problem here? Is it a problem that we don't have adequate laws to criminalize this conduct? Or is the problem that we don't have adequate enforcement in order to make those laws have real bite?
Well, I think the enforcement issue is a really big problem. So I've been dealing with this Section 54 in the Modern Slavery Act of 2015, transparency in supply chains. And it actually, if you followed what it does, if you're a business and you followed what it does, you've got a turnover of £36 million or more, and you follow all the guidelines, you will have a pretty good idea of the risks that are entailed in your business. The problem is if you don't follow it and produce a one sentence statement, or if you don't even bother to produce a statement at all, nobody's going to come knocking on your door and ask you why. That is a problem. But I think there are other things that we can do and other things that we can think about. And I think one of the heartening things, and I hope we'll come on to some of those things later, one of the heartening things about it is there are so many people, many of whom are in business, who really want this to change and are prepared to go way beyond what the Act itself demands of them in order to make sure these things are improved. So I think that that's a really encouraging thing that's happened as a result of the law. So whatever kind of critique I have of it, I would say it's opened up a conversation that wasn't happening before. So I've been dealing with people from the fashion industry, from football, would you believe, from the construction industry, hospitality, a whole range of different areas. And I don't think any one sector can lay claim to being much, much better at it than anybody else. But what I would say is that because fashion has had to deal with it in so many ways for so long, that they're a little bit ahead of the game, some of them at least. Some of them are way ahead of the game in terms of seeing the problem and recognising that actually you've got to change your business model. You cannot operate in the same way, business as usual, and expect to eliminate this problem, because part of the problem is it's come out of the business practices that have become ingrained in the way in which we conduct ourselves. So it's really, and also the consumer as well. I mean, it's hard, and I never want to lay the blame at consumers' door because of all the issues around what we're encouraged to spend our money on and how we trust brands, and sometimes that trust is betrayed. But there is a role, I think, for citizens to play.
So let's talk about the successes. So part of it is businesses coming partly through enlightened leadership, partly through the activism of consumers, partly because they're trying to protect their brands. They're self-policing, and they're acting in a more enlightened way, and they're championing the kinds of causes you'd want to and eliminating the kinds of labor practices that you're trying to eliminate. But there will remain, if there are 45 million people who are experiencing conditions of modern slavery, there have to be dark pockets where you have businesses that don't have enlightened leaders and where sort of criminal enterprises still ply their trade. So what can you do to help move the ball and help eliminate these practices or move people towards better practices? And where have you seen success?
Where I think you see the success is through really good leadership. And so one particular fashion company that we work with, and I never name them because it becomes a bit invidious to do so, but they've taken the bull by the horns, as it were, and said, okay, we don't accept that this is acceptable practice. We cannot have this, whether it's in our factories at home, and believe me, there are still some of these things going on here in the UK, whether it's in our factories at home or abroad, we must do something about this. So what is it that we can do in terms of encouraging the people that we work with to change their practices, as well as having a good, long, hard look at ours? So what we've done, in my colleagues and I in the House of Lords, we've said, okay, can we have a conversation about this? Why don't you bring the people that you think can be influential in an even wider way than you are yourselves? Bring them into the House of Lords and let's go through what it is that we need to do, how we're going to do it, and why it's really, really important to do this. Now, I always say to them, actually, it's not my job to work out how you need to change what you do. That's your problem. You've brought yourselves to this particular situation, and therefore you've got the means, you've got the intellect, you've got the practical knowledge, you've got the experience, you've got the people you can call on to work out how you can get out of this situation. The most important thing, and this is the thing that I think we can do, is to encourage you to do that and to support you in doing that, and to say that we're not here to call you out because you make a mistake. So let's say, for example, something is turned up in one of your factories that is really poor practice. We're not going to call you out, and the NGOs I work with aren't going to call you out, as long as you're prepared to have the dialogue that leads us towards doing something differently in the future. And so, you know, as far as that goes, you've got our support, and that's the way we've been working, rather than trying to lay down the law, because, as I said earlier, the law doesn't have that amount of teeth. The other thing I think is important to say is it's really interesting how this piece of legislation is now, at one time it was like world leading. Now it's not, because other jurisdictions are bringing out more stringent, more rigorous legislation. And I think eventually we could have effectively what is a legislative ring of fire, as it were. And that's where I see something really, really productive could come out. If we can get the top businesses in the world, plus the jurisdictions where this legislation has been introduced, plus the NGOs, plus citizen activism, we can work together, I think, to greatly diminish this particular form of abuse.
You mentioned a little bit your work in the House of Lords, and we started this conversation by speaking a little bit about the circumstances of your childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And I would venture to say that a less likely candidate to land up in the House of Lords than you, they're not many. So tell us how that happened.
Actually, I don't know. To be honest with you, okay, I've been in the House of Lords now for 15 years. But if anybody had said to me 18 years ago, that's where I was going to be, I would have thought, what are you saying? What are you talking about? It's rubbish. For a start, that needed a legislative change. So let's forget that when Labour were in government, part of the, I would say, very limited reform of the House of Lords was to get rid of a lot of the hereditary peers, but not all, but also to introduce a new form of crossbench independent peer, which was, I think, rather mistakenly called the people's peers. So what that meant, the message was meant to be, didn't matter who you were, you had the possibility of coming into the House of Lords to do some really good public service. And obviously that's not quite true. And there were lots of kinds of critiques of that message at the time. But for me, it represented a very interesting route into doing something that I would never have thought of before. And what it offered, quite frankly, was a bit of power and influence and a way of consolidating some of the work with which I've been involved in a way that could feed into legislation, into the legislative framework, to become part of that. And also that wider sphere of influence that you gain as a result of being there. How can you use that to good effect? So that's at this end of it. So between that and the foster home and all the rest of it, as I say, that kind of sense of injustice not being right, and how could I just sit around and moan about it without actually doing something, and having got involved with the union in acting, and then moving through these issues around race and representation, going into academia, doing that robust analysis of culture, its contents and its discontents, and thinking through what change might mean if you were able to link policy, practice, academic thinking and activism in quite an interesting way. And then, as I say, the politics, I suppose I got into the real politics, if you like, at City Hall, the Greater London Authority, when I was head of culture there. It wasn't always a happy experience, I have to say, but I learned a lot about how politics worked, and I carried that over into the House of Lords.
Tell us a little bit about how easy it is to be an advocate for positive social change in politics, and what the challenges have been as you've experienced it from sitting from the House of Lords.
Wow. Well, the challenges are always going to be huge, always going to be huge. And I think when you're not aligned to a political party, people are a little bit suspicious of you. They equate that with sitting on the fence sometimes, or with just not being knowledgeable enough. And I will happily admit to not being totally au fait with party politics, thankfully, because from what I've seen, I'm really glad not to be embroiled in all of that. Although I do think, obviously, you can do some really good work through those structures. So I guess that independence has come from going back to childhood, having to be relatively independent from quite a young age, and then sort of thinking about sort of bringing myself up and sorting myself out, not had those kind of familial structures on which to depend. So to forge my own path has sort of felt, with lots of support from friends and so on. So it's not as if this, I'm not saying I've done it totally on my own. Of course not, that's not possible. But through reading and thinking and discussing and debating and having friends, that's always been a large part of shaping the way in which I think about things. And when I first joined the Lords, I had this convoluted idea and totally idealistic nonsense that I was going to sort of have like a kind of court of people, the people whose opinions I really valued, and I would consult them on the big issues on which I was about to vote, but never kind of worked out that way. But I think, you know, the challenge is, and I think particularly now maybe, the challenge is to keep thinking that it's possible to change things. And I will not tolerate people saying, oh, we can't change anything, or everything's horrible and everybody's miserable and we're all depressed and we're all divided. And, you know, I see it as, you know, we can't fall into that trap, because once that's a downward spiral. So there is always something that's possible. And as I was saying, you know, it's encouraging to me that some of the biggest businesses, high street names that we know, are really absolutely, it's not just about a kind of whitewashing or greenwashing exercise, because obviously environmental issues are really important here too. It is something that they really feel deeply committed to. We have to change the way we do things. Now, it may be that they're one of a minority within that company, but there are those people who think that. And as long as those people are around, the more we can grow that as a kind of movement in inverted commas, and to get people to realise where they do have power. I think particularly with young people, and for me it's completely the utmost priority to ensure that whatever we mean by somebody's by individual or collective legacy, something that is really positive for young people to grasp hold of and to move things forward again. And I think that is happening. I've never subscribed to the idea that young people are apathetic and don't care. I think, a bit like me in some respects, a lot of them can't find a structure into which to fit their way of thinking, or that is open enough to take a sort of broad range of perspectives. So to me, it's not about being optimistic or pessimistic. It's about trying to be realistic, but also trying to think in a positive way that things can change.
So you strike me, notwithstanding your statement about not being an optimist or a pessimist, as essentially optimistic about the human condition, about our ability to change. And I wonder, you know, whether you agree with, you know, Martin Luther King's much abused quote that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Do you think that's the case, and are you an optimist?
I reject the term. I'm going to reject the term optimist again, because it kind of like this false kind of Pollyanna-ish thing, and pessimistic is a kind of Victor Meldrew sort of side of all that. I'm not interested in that. But what I'm interested in, if you look at history, and we're all around for such a short time, so we're dependent on other people's accounts. We're dependent on a range of perspectives on history. And again, one must point out that that is also inflected by people's personal, social and cultural and indeed national context within which they're writing and which their views have been formed. But so if we look at history, there's two different ways of looking at this, I think. One is that history is hugely long. Yes, of course it is, you know, thousands, millennia. And if you look from, as it were, people dwelling in caves to now, there's a huge amount of progress. We're now in a stage where we don't accept. We're now in a phase where at least we know that actually it's quite wrong to be racist, to judge people in a racist way, or to go around beating people up because they've got a different skin tone or different sexuality to the one you think. We know it still goes on, and hate crimes against disabled people still goes on, but at least we do now know that that is wrong, and people will be called out on that. So even in my lifetime, that has changed. You know, I mean, as I say, I used to come home from school and walk a vanguard of boys from a local secondary school calling me all kinds of racial epithets. That was the kind of norm in the 50s and early 60s. We don't do that now. So things do change. And those images I saw, we still see, of course we still see police officers shooting black men and all that racial conflict and so on and so forth. But we have I think we're beginning to develop a better understanding of why that actually isn't a long-term position that we can hold for the health of the human race. So I think we do move on. So there's a very slow thing. But at the same time, we have to think it must be possible to fast forward, to make a big leap forward by... we can't just sit back and think, oh, well, it's going to change anyway. We needn't do anything.
Tell us a little bit about your view about anger in politics. Let me ask you the question in a different way.
Mm.
If you describe some of your early life experiences, there would be very surprising if both for yourself, but somebody who loved you very much would not look on in incredible anger at some of the racism and discrimination that you experienced as a young girl. And there's much to make us angry about the state of the world today. And so I wonder whether you think how anger can or should be deployed as a way of trying to lead to change, or whether you think there are more or less productive ways of campaigning.
It's an interesting question, because anger has very negative connotations, doesn't it? Because it's often linked to aggression. which is bad. So I get angry about all kinds of things, but it's how that anger manifests itself, I guess. I can get angry. I can get as angry and depressed as the next person, actually. But as I say, you know, my thought has to be, okay, what am I going to do with that anger? Because I think that unchanneled anger can be dangerous. And we also know that there are certain demagogues who are very adept at channeling that anger in very destructive ways for society. So I think anger is something we should feel angry. I mean, I watched a film last night, The Island of Hungry Ghosts. It's about Christmas Island and the asylum detainees, some of whom have been there for 5 years on an island, on an inhospitable island. And it's completely outrageous. So I'm trying to think through, how come a government which has introduced some of the most robust anti-modern slavery legislation that we would want to emulate here, also, at the same time, detain people who've committed no crime other than to want a better life for themselves in these horrendous circumstances? That does make me angry. But it doesn't mean I go flailing around and hitting things and people and what have you. I then have to think, well, you know, have I got the energy to take on something else, or can I direct other people towards addressing that? Or, you know, what is my role going to be in doing something, no matter how small, about that, having seen that film? And it goes back to an earlier thing that we were talking about, is what is the role of culture in shaping people's ideas and informing people about what goes on around the world? Because although I'd heard about it vaguely, seeing it and the way it was photographed and filmed and listening to people speak and cry and everything was a whole other experience.
So talking about coming back to the question of culture, you have now participating in something called the Staunch Book Prize.
Oh, yes.
And I'd love you to tell us a little bit about what this book prize is and what it's for and why you're involved.
Well, yes, the Staunch Book Prize is a very interesting one. It's only the second year in which it's been going. And I'm a great lover of thrillers, okay? I make no bones about it. I love a good thriller, a good detective mystery story from the Golden Age or more recently or whatever. And lots of people know this. So I was asked to become a member of the judging panel for the Staunch Prize, which is specifically set up to look at books that are in the thriller genre, detective and so on, but which do not depend on the rape, murder, vicious beating up of women. It's quite a simple premise. You wouldn't have thought it would cause such a stir, but apparently lots of people take exception to that, including some crime writers, and have accused it of being censorship, which of course it isn't. Perfectly at liberty to write that in any way, shape or form you like, and they will continue to do so. And actually, I do read some of those too. But I thought, oh my gosh, recently I had begun to think, I'm fed up with, you know, a serial killer that picks on nubile young women, you know, again, and all the multiple disgusting ways in which he will torture those young women before he is caught and put away by an equally dubious detective inspector. You know, so it's just a change, just seeing and reading something different. So I'm really looking forward to reading those books.
They're a group of people who are in much earlier stages of their life. They're starting out their careers. They're perhaps about to go to university. And they're wanting to try and think about how they lead a life of greater purpose. And you're a person who's had a sort of gold thread of purpose throughout your whole life. So I'm going to start with a harder question and then an easier one. The first one is a question about failure. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, something that you've done that hasn't succeeded or that other people might learn from and not have to go through that themselves?
Well, you know, I'm not a big fan of these big binaries like success versus failure. So, and, you know, without wishing to sound trite, I think everything that you do that other people might label successful, I certainly always think, oh my gosh, I wish I'd done that differently. I wish I'd seen that particular pothole before we actually fell in it or whatever, even in something that looks like it's being wildly successful. So that's the first thing I would say. And actually, I think you're right in terms of it is now much easier to talk about failure. I have to accept we live in a world of binary. So, yeah, I accept that it's easier to talk about things that haven't worked out so well. So I would say, rather than any one specific thing, which is not to say, of course, that I've been incredibly successful in everything I've tried to do, but it's like, to me, I think about continually, how can I improve the way, for example, dealing with people who work for you whose standard of work isn't up to what you would like. But a perfectly nice person who needs that job and wants to get on and thinks they're doing quite well, I find that really difficult. And sometimes I've dodged that by simply not addressing it and then have to deal with difficult consequences afterwards. Equally, it needn't necessarily be about an employee. There's been some of those political situations I've been in where I thought, I'm not handling this relationship with this person very well because I can't tell them that I think that they're talking a load of rubbish or that, you know, they're completely wrong on this particular issue. So I think for me, it's more those kinds of things. How can I sharpen up the way that I deal with these difficult conversations?
If you think about all the different things you've worked on that have led to change, what skills have you had or wished you'd had, or encourage people to have, that you think will make them better at leading a life that leads to social change?
Well, I would say skills and attributes. And I think, you know, you said several times about the sense of purpose. I think it's absolutely crucial. And for me, it's that thing that keeps me alive in a way, keeps the mind buzzing, because there's always something to do. So I suppose I would also say that everybody has their own way of going about these things. But I took a decision I took a positive decision about, oh, I don't know, 25 years ago, that I would set myself some goals about what I wanted to do. So when I was in the academic world, I thought, well, yeah, I want to be a professor. So what do I need to do in order to become a professor? I need to write a lot. I need to go to conferences. I need to talk. I need to understand. I need to learn. And I need to listen. And I would choose people that I admired in the academic world and think about how I could emulate the way they came across, not be them or be like them, that's a bit creepy, but it would be, it's about how I could be that kind of person who obviously is listening to what people are saying and then can play it back to them in a way that encourages them to say more as a teacher, for example. So that I think is really important to look, listen and learn, absolutely. I also think that I like to think that I try to be as open as possible. And so if somebody says, if somebody says, oh, it would be really useful if somebody in the House of Lords paid attention to what's going on in the fashion industry. And I think, oh, I'll do that because I like fashion and I like politics. So tell me about the politics of fashion. I didn't know anything about supply chains 10 years ago. I didn't know anything about forced labour or domestic servitude 10 years ago, but I listened to people, heard what they were saying, and thought, well, this is something to which I might be able to make a contribution. So it's being open about that. Similarly with the work around criminal justice, I had a feel for that, because when you're in care, you're quite aware that a lot of people that you've been in care with will end up in prison. So what can I bring to that conversation that other people can't bring because they haven't experienced being in care? And how can I work with ministers? How can I work with people? So it's about also, I think what I'm saying is, your knowledge, experience and skills and attributes are not just about the things that are on paper that says you got a 2:1 from Oxford University. You know, they go much further beyond that. and much more embedded in who and what you are and who and what you want to be, I think. So sense of purpose, absolutely critical. And then having that sense of, in a broad sense, it's not like, you know, when people ask, oh, what would you like? Yes, I'd like to end world poverty. Yes, that's great. We'd all like to, well, most of us would like to end world poverty, but meanwhile, you know, what is it that you want to do? So for me, I think my thing has been, I will not be the bystander. I don't want to be that person who sits around moaning about the state of the world, but who's not prepared to do anything to try and change at least a little corner of that. You know, the Facing History group, they have this saying, you know, be an upstander, not a bystander. So you can't let things pass. If you're in a situation where it's safe for you to challenge, or where you, if you're in a position where you're able to challenge some of these things that are going on, don't be the person who just says, well, it's somebody else's responsibility. I got to take responsibility for that.
Lola Young, I think that is an absolutely beautiful note in which to end. You've led a life in which you have been not a bystander, but an upstander, and an inspiration to so many people. And I think people will learn a lot from having listened to you today. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. The podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. Please also visit theconduit.com, where you can find more information on The Conduit and our community of inspiring changemakers.